Hello and welcome back to the Vacation Bible School Podcast. My name is Jason Kirk. Joined, you're not going to believe it, folks. We are joined today by a special guest. It's Emily Kirk. Hello. How are we?
Hi. Oh, fine. Thank you for having me.
On this program, we are going back through the entire Holy Bible, rediscovering things we've, you know, probably haven't thought about all that much since, like, you know, high school youth group, and finding every single bit of it is far more fascinating and weird and rabbit holy than we were ever led to believe as church kids. This is not a program that argues you have to believe all of it. This is not a program that argues you can't believe any of it. This is a program that takes you as you are, anywhere in between or even beyond those spectrums if you find a way. That'd be pretty impressive. But we have made our way through the book of Genesis, almost all the book of Exodus, and guess what, folks? Here today, we are going to finish the book of Exodus.
Hooray!
After it's been almost a year and we finished two books, so...
Well, not quite a year. I mean, we have a few months.
So to catch you up on what has happened, Moses and them have defeated the Pharaoh, made their way across the Red Sea. They've developed new holidays and traditions and so forth. They received the Ten Commandments. There was a thing with a golden calf. And now God has presented them with what they are going to do instead of a golden calf. God wants a big traveling tent with special things that burn meat a way God likes, because as we recall way back to the very beginning of Genesis, God likes smoked meats. So do I. Because I'm made in his image. we think about, like, well, ancient world, if you don't exactly know what is at the top of the sky, what happens when you burn something? Smoke goes up. Where does it go? It disappears. Well, God must be taking it, right? It kind of makes sense. God likes smoke.
They didn't have a whole lot of options either, though.
As far as what?
As far as cooking meats go.
Right. They couldn't microwave it, you mean?
Well, I mean, like, when there's fire, there's smoke.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that.
Yeah, so that was about the only cooking option that time.
There's going to be smoke, and it's going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So, this is where it gets pretty complicated. We're going to have fun on this episode. We're going to have fun, or we are going to turn this church bus around, and we will not be going to the lake to play on the ropes course. We are going to have fun today. But this part of the Bible is, I think, the sloggiest slog in the entire book. Yes, I'm aware of what begins the book of Chronicles, and I will actually defend that once we get to it, by the way. I'm aware of the entire book of Leviticus. Leviticus is fascinating, okay? We'll get there soon. The story of the tabernacle. It's kind of not a story. It's instructions repeated over and over. Emily, first question. tell the truth to these people. Did you read these chapters?
No.
Okay.
On purpose, sort of.
That was wise. Because we did get a fast-moving version for children that we'll talk about in a little bit.
I know all the information that you do, and I didn't have to read all of it. So
so you're the wise one here.
Well, I will probably plan on reading it, because, I mean, I have to say that I read the whole Bible throughout this. I mean, if we take 10 years to do this podcast and I still haven't read the whole Bible, there's a problem.
So the chapters in question are here. It's the stuff basically from the Ten Commandments onward, basically the entire latter half of Exodus, more or less. Moses goes up and receives these blueprints from God. Next question. When we were kids, mm-hmm. you know, what did we learn about the tabernacle?
I don't remember a whole lot other than after it had already been established, pretty much. So I just remember there being colorful cloths and things like that. That was probably my main memory, because those are what you see in pictures.
Yeah. I remember I've kind of poked gentle fun at the thing a lot of Christians do, where they go back into Old Testament stories, Hebrew Bible stories, and they say, aha, there, Jesus, foreshadowing, which, if you want to see that, that's totally fine. The tabernacle was a big thing with that. It's got blood, it's got wood, right? And it even ties directly into the story of the crucifixion, because the tabernacle, which eventually becomes Solomon's temple, and then eventually becomes a whole other temple. What happens to the veil that separates the holiest place from the rest of the world? When Jesus dies, it is torn in half. The symbolism is obvious. So the tabernacle for me was always, it's all we ever heard about it was Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. So let's get into these blueprints. So a thing to remember about blueprints is God has handed them out before. He gave Noah like four verses on how to build the lifeboat that was going to save all of animal kind.
So much detail.
But now he will spend way, way, way more than that on a traveling tailgate. I think it's the best way to describe it.
I mean, to be fair, this was the thing that God was creating for mankind to worship him at this point. When they built the ark, it was like, okay, you guys need to live to protect these animals, but whatever, everyone's dying. So they didn't really need to spend a whole lot of time on that. They just needed like a few people to survive. So
at this point, God has established that he is stuck with these people.
Right. Like he promised he's not going to wipe them all out again.
At the time of the ark, there is a little lingering question. And the movie, the Russell Crowe movie that we watched, it sort of draws it out of the text where it's like, God's like, all right, I'm going to keep the people too. Fine. And at this point in the story, as of after the Exodus, God has decided I am very much stuck with these people. So,
right.
So God gives him the instructions for a tailgate. And literally, it's a traveling communal gathering space that smokes meat. It is what you do before you go to a sporting event. Everyone brings meat and you smoke it. Hey, guess what? You're going to church every Saturday or Sunday or whichever day you worship at your favorite football stadium. So the tabernacle is a mobile home for God among a traveling people. And it is going to be described in detail, socket by socket and loop by loop. We talked in the creation episode about how there's these different authors coming in and out of the text as you read. There's like, you know, the wacky Uncle God author where God is kind of this like friendly Loki. and then there's the other authors that are very, very, very different, who are rituals and steps and calendars and lineages and diagrams. When you see that stuff, you are very likely reading a priest who very often came along hundreds of years later and after everybody had their fun and tried to like put it in order.
These are the people that are like, this is the history we need to remember.
These are very much the guys who are like, so there's a story about a global flood and, you know, the greatest action story of all time. But what was the calendar like? That's what the priests are worried about when they go back and edit the flood story.
I kind of get it because without the calendar, nothing makes sense. Even though still nothing makes sense within the terms of time that we've already talked about up to this point.
Yeah.
So it's funny that the calendar is so important.
The priests do what they can. And when you see like, you know, again in Genesis, when we go directly from like, yeah, the universe begins and there's a snake and it kind of goes wrong. And then you see, and so-and-so begat so-and-so and so-and-so begat so-and-so. And then there's a flood and everything goes crazy. Okay, let's focus. So-and-so begat. That's the priests trying via montage to stitch everything into order. So, tabernacle stuff, it is priest as can be. We get 13 verses on an extremely fancy acacia and gold box that will store the documents that God is drawing up with Moses, the Ten Commandments, the world's greatest filing cabinet. Yes, it's the Ark of the Covenant. It will become a superpower MacGuffin for like the next 10 books, and then it'll later melt a Nazi's face in a documentary from a few years ago. It has gold cherubim carved around it. We joked in our first episode about how the word conjures fat, naked babies. Cherubim are, of course, four-legged, winged creatures like Egyptian sphinxes. Their wings are protecting the ark. Whenever you read a Bible verse about God's wings shielding us, it might be referring to things like these cherubs. The cherubim become super important Jewish political symbols that rival bull calves, like the golden calf, for a time. As we'll discuss many episodes from now, whenever you see a cherubim, you can also think in the back of your mind, ah, this is the side of the Jewish kingdom that likes cherubim and not bulls, calves. This ark, this special box, is considered the footstool of God's throne. Storing agreements beneath the feet of idols was also an ancient Hittite and Egyptian thing, writes John Gray. This area around the box is called the most holy place. 8 verses on a table that goes next to the ark and holds sacrificial bread. 10 on a 7-lamped branched lampstand. And as always, people have spent 2,500 years debating exactly what the first menorah looked like, whether the branches were straight or curved. Endless hours of debate. And a version, of course, becomes, you know, a symbol of Hanukkah. And God, even at some point, Moses is being a visual learner, and he's not picturing what God is describing. And God literally draws on the mountain to show Moses the pattern he wants. We get 10 verses on the incense altar, whose smoke will protect the priests from the raw holiness of God. 5 verses on the incense itself. 36 verses on the linen curtains and goat hair tents that surround all this stuff. 21 verses on the part of the tabernacle that's under the tent, but not the holy place, the carport, so to speak. This is where the very complicated altar goes. Again, no longer made out of some rocks we found, like they did in Genesis, but out of exactly manipulated wood and bronze and silver. 4 verses on the bronze basin the priests wash in before going into the holy place. 12 verses on how to make the holy anointing oil the priests use. God puts Aaron, our buddy from the Golden Calf episode.
Here he comes again.
He's still a very important Levite. The Levites are in charge, and Aaron's in charge of the tabernacle. Technically, his sons are going to be a couple of the first people to actually fire the thing up and use it. That'll happen in Leviticus. I'm sure it'll go really, really well.
It usually does.
Now, if you want to see grace and mercy in this story, well, God saw that Aaron tried to do the right thing amid a furious mob, and God did not lose faith in Aaron, right? All right. There are now 43 verses on what high priest Aaron and them should wear. Tons of very specific jewels representing the 12 tribes of Israel. This high priest lineage will last until 70 AD, roughly a millennium if you take the entire story as definite history canon. The Levites thus go from bringing the unruly warriors envisioned by Jacob to the golden calf the Avengers, to a very important religious tribe. 43 more verses on how Aaron is supposed to do very specific bloody sacrifices just to cleanse himself enough to do other bloody sacrifices. Smoke and fire and meat smells, and God is going to love this. And hey, here's a throwback. Everything is, you know, more ornate and elaborate than before, but still, just like with Abraham, smoke and meat and blood. And again, obviously, yes, Jesus foreshadowing. 11 verses on God giving two guys Bezalel and Aholiab, or something like that. He gives them like tech boosts, unlocking lumberjackery and metalworking and smithing so that they can be the foreman of this project. And somewhere around here, it seems like God's having fun, right? Like God, you know, we're past the golden calf thing. The whole blueprint is kind of repeated. Like it's handed out once before the golden calf thing, and then God's kind of like, all right, let me take it from the top, right? And it's somewhere in there, once the people are starting to get it, starting to pick up on exactly how God wants this thing to work, it's almost like God's having fun creating with his kids. More verses, 6 on how to do a census and collect taxes for the funding of this whole structure. So the priestly authors really wanted to write some endless repetitive blueprints. And that's a weird way to tell a story. But Robert Alter has a story explanation. Maybe the editors who pasted in this whole diagram wanted the reader to feel like God is still in control, even still here in the desert. We're low on water. The mountain is scary. The Levites just killed some guys. But there's a plan. How dangerous could things be if we are in the middle of an instruction manual? So, if you don't want to read all that, the better way to do it is, hey, we found a YouTube video.
This is a good part.
So we're going to talk to the guy who made it. We are now delighted to be joined by a special guest, Reverend Chris Lee of St. John's with St. Mary's Church in Mansfield. I can't speak.
Yeah, Mansfield.
Okay. of the Church of England, he creates a lot of very cool stuff for the internet, cool churchy pastor stuff with his wife, Ruth, on his Facebook, YouTube, the primary avenues, right, where people can find you online?
Yeah, that's right.
Rev D. Chris Lee is the handle. And there's
because someone had already taken Rev Chris Lee, so I had to go Revd Chris Lee. that was all that was left.
Well, it was funny because, like, all right, so we're going to talk about a thing that, like, the way that, you know, the thing that led us to you was a thing on YouTube where I found the handle and I'm like, wait, there's two very online Chris Lees of, you know, the Anglican Church, and like, you guys have split up the internet. He's Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and YouTube.
Yeah, that's right.
So we're going to talk to you today for like a few reasons that I think sort of tie into the tabernacle story. But first, can we ask you for sort of, you know, what has led you to this point in your faith, in your life and all that stuff?
Yeah, so I was born in a Christian family. So my dad's a vicar as well. Are people going to know what a vicar is when I talk about being a vicar?
They do now.
Right.
Very Protestant, largely Protestant, somewhat Catholic, some other stuff that they've picked up on it by now, I think.
Sweet. My dad was a vicar as well. So I grew up in a Christian home, grew up knowing all the stories of the Bible. I've still got a copy of my kind of big like Bible storybook with all the pictures in. That's what I grew up with. So have always kind of had that kind of close relationship with the story of the Bible and with the story of God and God and us and how that relates. And I think like early on in life, I almost thought it was like a game of knowledge. How much do you know? Would you score 100% in a Bible trivia quiz? And I was like, yeah, I would nail that. I'd be great at that. So I thought that was what made me a good Christian, kind of early on in life. But when I was kind of around 10 or 11, that was when we started going to some of the, kind of bigger Christian festivals, because you know we lived in quite a small town, so there weren't that many kids my age there, and we started going to some bigger Christian festivals, and I heard teaching about how it was important to have a relationship with God, and so it was around 10 or 11 that I realized it wasn't about just knowing stuff about God, it was about knowing God personally, and so that was the start of my transforming my experience of being a Christian and knowing God, but that kind of that process took some time, I think, through my teenage years. I think teenage years are difficult for everyone, there were definitely ups and downs in that, but kind of coming into like when I got to around 18, I think I really started to settle. There are a few experiences in my life, one of those being my first experience of being able to lead in children's work. I don't know, there's always been something for me about when you try to teach something to someone else, that's when it really becomes clear for you. And so that was a time of my faith really just becoming something solid and dependable and like a really big part of my life. I always said I wasn't going to do what my dad does. Because it's always the question you get asked as a vicar's kid. It's like, oh, are you going to follow in your dad's footsteps? Are you going to be a vicar as well? I was like, no. And I went through so many different career options of what I wanted to be, like a fireman and an architect and all kinds of things. But God has an amazing sense of humor. I started off training as a teacher because I was really enjoying that experience of teaching people. Became a primary school teacher for a couple of years. Kind of during that time, I thought, I just felt like there was something that wasn't quite what I wanted to do, what God wanted for my life. And so I felt like, and I think the main thing for me there was that I wanted to talk about what really mattered. And you can't talk about some of the things that really matter to you when you're a primary school teacher. You have to focus on reaching the targets in maths and English and stuff. And there's a verse in Ecclesiastes that says, I tried adding one thing to another and it was meaningless. And I think that's
how I feel about math.
that's where I got to. Like I liked math. And I was good at it, but I just felt like there was more to what I wanted to teach children about than that. So I transferred from being a primary school teacher to being a children's worker for a church. And so that's kind of been, that kind of brought me into working for the church. And again, it was one of those things where everyone says to children's workers, when are you going to get a real job? When are you going to get ordained, become a vicar? And I was like, no, children's working is a great job. I'm going to be this until I'm 85 and I'm still going to be telling children about Jesus. Again, God had a sense of humor. And eventually, after a few years of being a children's worker, called me into this path towards becoming a vicar. And so I've now been a vicar for just coming up to a year now.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So you're coming up, you know, working with kids and stuff. It still shines through because a lot of the stuff you make is like, it's still very kid focused, right? Like, it's like a youth pastor who is a pastor. And
And we're part of a church which has got a heart for being a church for young people. So we do really want to do that. And in the UK, I don't know what it's like in America, but in the UK, we've seen a decline in church attendance. And that decline is doubled in people under the age of 18. And so we're actually in a pretty dire place for children's work and for work with young people in the churches in the UK. So we just wanted to really commit to being a church that is going all out to bring the hope and life that Jesus offers to children and young people.
So you did something pretty cool along those lines that relates to the subject of this episode, and it was actually how I found you. I was looking on, reading the Tabernacle story and thinking like, oh man, so many details, so much to picture, and lots of people have depicted it in paintings. And people have built it.
We thought about buying a kit.
We could buy a kit. There's Lego versions, but I'm like, what is the online possible version? I wonder if anybody has done it in Minecraft. And I go and I search YouTube, and there's a bunch of versions. I was like, what? Lots of people have this spot. And then there's one that is a 24-minute tutorial. And I'm like, this is the one. And from scratch, and actually, I also clicked on it because it says Reverend. Right in your username, it was like, authoritative. But I click on it, and it's this whole, not just a step-by-step from scratch tabernacle, lovingly recreated according to what the Bible says, and like citing research and tying in little sermons here and there. It's like from literally, dirt all the way through complete tabernacle.
And details. And if you couldn't do the details, you explained why you couldn't and what should be there.
Yeah, it's even facing the right way. You see the sun going the correct way, and it's in the middle of nowhere, which is where it should be. So, yeah, what inspired that? What kind of research goes into that? And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, inspiration wise, my Minecraft username is Captain Bezalel. Bezalel being one of the people who God inspires as one of the ones who creates things for the tabernacle. And so I think Minecraft for me has always been a reflection of that creativity of God, that he is a creative God, and he made us in his image. And I think part of being that image is being creative people. So I've always found Minecraft to be a place that is, you can have fun in it, but you can have fun in a way that completely is part of your worship of God, of creating things. And so I think it was quite natural for me to go for that. It also tied in well with what we were doing at that time in our children's work series. That's why I ended up making the tabernacle. And it was interesting trying to research it when it's talking about all the lengths of cloth, it doesn't exactly describe how you kind of lay them out so that they create a complete tent. It does quite well at describing it, but you're kind of left with this thing where you're kind of like, so how does that exactly fit together? And so I actually got bits of cloth and was like trying to work out how bits of cloth of that measurement would fit over to create something that would be kind of watertight and stuff. So I did a bit of research, but I also did trying to build it myself and to see, what's the logical way of this working? How must this have worked? And it was really good fun. I just wanted to share it with people.
We loved all the little, my favorite detail. There's a lot of really cool ones. Once the whole thing is complete, the Holy of Holies, you've made these banners and the banners, you have like this pile of shapes that you're putting, and you're actually doing it within the game using a loom to put angel designs on the banners. Like, how long did it take to figure out the right set of, because there's not an angel shape in Minecraft. You had to make it. Trial and error there.
That was just impressive to me.
I just Googled it. Someone's going to have worked out how to make something that looks like a winged being in Minecraft on banners. And luckily someone had, and there was a step-by-step thing. So not my own work. I probably should have credited that when I made the video.
What you did was exactly what the Israelites did. You were tying together the work of the community into one greater thing.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. Skills that we learned in Egypt, we put together into the into building a place for God. And I think my other thing about Minecraft is, for me, Minecraft almost seems like it's ideally designed to bring things in the Bible to life. Because you know, it's kind of almost as if it's trying to be set in a time period of kind of swords and bows and arrows and things. But it's also got that capability to create moving parts when you kind of get into all the redstone stuff. I don't know how much you know about Minecraft, but like the fact that the end goal, as it were, of the game is to get to the end scene where you fight a dragon. Yes. I'm just like, this is like the same as the Bible. You know, we have that scene.
It's really weird and really dark toward the end, but it's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like the dragon.
So it's always felt to me like it's been a really natural place to explore the Bible. And I think if I had more time, I would kind of create a whole Bible world. So the tabernacle is on something that I'm very slowly creating as an explorable Bible world. So we've just recently been doing about stories from the exile with our kids church and with our adults church, because it really feels like it relates to us in lockdown. But we were looking at things like Ezekiel's vision that he sees on the banks of the river, which is just a crazy vision, but it's so visual. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to give people a chance to see, like, what could that have looked like? And so I had a go at building that. So that the next Minecraft YouTube video that'll be coming out from me will be a tutorial on how to build Ezekiel's vision.
Oh man, one of the craziest things in the whole Bible. Let's do it.
Yeah.
You can do it like so like, because like story wise and like there's some archaeological reason to think, and like it just makes sense, like Solomon's temple ultimately like constructed like as a bigger tabernacle around the tabernacle, like you could expand.
Sure.
That.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, our daughter, she's a huge Minecraft kid. And like I've tried to play along, and like, but her and all her cousins, they play it constantly. She watches the tutorials and everything. She approved. She thought it was cool. As you go, there's a rabbit just hopping around the tabernacle the entire time. She wanted the rabbit to have a name. That was her only edit note for you. And I think I have a suggestion. The tabernacle rabbit, we just call it the rabernacle.
I love it. I'll get in there and do it as soon as I can.
That was another thing you did. As the pieces you use, it's not just acacia wood. You change it to exactly what the Bible calls it, right? to the trouble of changing the name of this thing we see for a half second to exactly what the Bible calls it. Like, so that's a question. Like, when you're doing something in a video game, but it's also a depiction of like the holiest place, like how much reverence do you feel playing Minecraft in that moment?
That's a really interesting question. I think I didn't feel a sense of reverence beyond that same sense of, you know, I'm being creative in a way that I was made to be. I think for me, it's not... I've not created a true kind of holy of holies. All I've created is something to help visualize what it would be. So yeah, I don't think I really thought of it in those terms beyond what I already feel about Minecraft anyway.
Gotcha. Okay. That's probably for the best. I was just watching it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If I was doing this, I would feel like, you know, oh man, I can't mess this up. You know, because we see in Leviticus what happens to guys who mess up, right? They get blown up, yeah. Right?
But I think it made a difference too, because it was obvious that you're very knowledgeable about the tabernacle, because going through it, it's not like you're like, oh, let me go see about this, or let me check on this and make sure I get this right. Like, if he or I were doing that, well, I can't do Minecraft. I can't do video games. I'm terrible, but...
I think I could handle the, like, all right, I figured out what... And Evie could build it.
Yeah.
I'm not touching it, but...
But it would be a lot of back and forth and making sure we got things right, where you were so confident in it, which was pretty impressive.
I mean, that's the magic of video editing for you.
Yeah.
I make it look like it's kind of almost in real time, because you've got my face reacting to it in real time. But I recorded the whole thing in Minecraft, and then commented over my own recording once I'd got it right. So I knew that it was all going to go right when I started commentating over it.
So like the tabernacle is kind of the perfect circle, because like, you know, in the Bible stuff gets built all the time. It's one of the first things that happens is a thing gets built. But like, none of it is as detailed as this. Like, the detail is just off the chart. Like, the ark, Noah's ark, it's explained in like two verses. I'd have to look it up. It's like a few sentences to build the like world-saving ark. Whereas this is chapter after chapter after chapter, and they're all repeated. Like, half the book of Exodus is how to build this thing, right? So like, the details are perfect for this game, but also I think it ties into a thing you talk about like, you know, it's about the work and it's about the caring and it's about the process and it's about the community coming together to build the thing, right? Like,
yeah.
I think that's what all the instructions bring out, is like, it's about the making.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's, I don't know if this is a good point to transition into talking about what we get from that in our worship today and in the Church of England in particular. I think we're thinking about a culture and a time where there is a lot less literacy than we have today. And actually through most of history has been less literate than we are today. And so we have all these amazing things that help us to connect with God's story as people. So, you know, as you can imagine, as you approach the tabernacle to see the whatever images are woven into this cloth, the people's handiwork that's gone into it, it's all speaking a story, and it's a visual and tactile reminder of who God is and what he's done for us. And I think, we see how easily the Israelites forget things. So to be able to have this concrete reminder that has got all this detail and beauty to it, I think it's there to help them remember the story, to help them have something to connect it all to. That's how I see our older churches in the UK, that, you know, the church that I was that I was an apprentice vicar in before I became a vicar, is a church that was begun that began being built 900 years ago. It's incredible. It's massive. It's solid stone and massive stained glass windows and all of these kind of things. And each detail of the bits that were built on it, it is trying to help point people to a story, the story of Jesus. And, you know, particularly stained glass windows are an obvious example of how that works, that you've got the picture stories of the Bible displayed for people to see. And I think for me, that's part of why there's detail there, why you want something beautiful and that you can see and touch, because it just helps to connect to that story.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think this also ties into, so when found you on YouTube, saw Reverend and thought like, I hope Anglican, because there's a specific thing I'm going to talk about, and then perfect. What are the odds? Because in the Anglican church, you know, I don't profess to be any sort of an expert or whatever, but there's this idea, high church and low church, that has sort of spread beyond just the Anglicans. Like, my fellow Protestants debate this among themselves as if, you know, the idea has just sort of spread. And we've sort of started calling it like, high church is, you know, like it's sort of Catholic. Low church is just sort of like, you're in the, you know, in the wilderness, in nature or whatever, you know, and it can be a whole spectrum in between there. So like an old building, right? Like that's beautiful. It's ancient. It's, you know, that's an example of high church. And the tabernacle, that is high church, right? At least in the desert, that's as high as it gets, but they're also in the desert and that's low church, right? So like, I don't know. It just sort of felt like things just are one on top of each other, you know, like.
Yeah, I think I get where you're coming from. And I think it's fascinating thing about, you know, the Church of England as a whole is that we attempt to be a church which holds both extremes. We go from cathedrals and 900-year-old churches to warehouses and schools and community centres and the wilderness. My wife would love the fact that you mentioned the wilderness as being an expression of church, because she's really into the outdoors and connecting with God in nature. But yeah, I think the fact that we have that variety in there, I think probably says something about the fact that God isn't just in one or the other. We can experience God across the whole kind of range of things. And to give you an example, in this 900-year-old church, we used to run a toddlers group because we didn't have a church hall connected to the church. So we just used this massive old stone building, put out some carpets and some toys, and invited in kind of parents and toddlers. And quite often you see the toddlers, they'll walk in through the door and they just stop and they look up and they just can't move for a second because they're just a bit taken aback by the surroundings. Like it's a complete sense of awe, and it's a sense of awe that, you know, there aren't many places in their lives that they can go into which are designed to create in them that sense of awe and wonder. And so I think it can be a really valuable way of helping people to stop from the daily grind and allow their eyes to lift and to look up and to think about bigger things.
I like hearing about this and the explanations for it and all that stuff. And like, I am sort of, you know, raised Protestant in a very like, this is the building, you go in it, you know. Like, there's nothing old or special. It was made 20 years ago. We're tear it down and make a new one in 5 years.
Make a bigger one.
Definitely,
yeah.
A bigger one.
Yeah, with like, escalators.
That's how I was raised, is like, no, you know, yeah. Pope can't tell me what to do. There's no 1500-year-old anything. Our guys made it up 6 years ago. They were the true church. You know, like, it's all, you know, brand new. We discovered, yeah, what Jesus meant, and we did it last month. But like, I'm also seeing, you know, how, like, you look at an Eastern Orthodox church that is like, you know, they're, you know, massive ceilings and paintings and chants and candles, and it's, you know, we're talking about mystical wisdom from thousands of years ago, and it's like, this is very awesome too. Like, I can go out in the woods and look at the sky and say that's God, but the, you know, looking at a, you know, a massive sculpture that people poured their hearts into, you know, like, okay, God is there too, you know. So like, yeah. For me, it's very cool to look at, you know, this portion of Exodus and see God saying, like, all right, Moses, if you just want to put up piles of rocks, that's fine. Israelites, I need you to do these billion steps.
Yes.
Fine too, because I like all of this. And then like later, like, you know, in Hosea, God says, right, like, it's not about that stuff. It's about whatever makes you act like me. You know, it's the sacrifices, they are there to remind you that you are mine, you know, that like the, it's about mercy, not sacrifice. And Jesus later quotes it, right? That like, yeah, all of this stuff, whether it's low church, high church, whatever, the point is what connects you to God. Am I on to anything at all here?
Yeah, I mean, that's so reflects what I've been thinking about as well. I mean, the verse that came to mind as I was thinking about this was Jesus saying the Sabbath was created for man, not man for the Sabbath. Like, all of these details, they weren't created to be like a chain around us. They were supposed to help us connect with God. And I think it's part of our responsibility, particularly in a traditional church like the Church of England, it's part of our responsibility to be constantly looking and saying, has this become something that's holding us back? Or is it still genuinely helping people to connect to God? So take, for example, the Book of Common Prayer, which written in 1662, it's beautiful language. And I guess on a level, I can appreciate that and the beauty of the language. And for a long time in England, it was good to use it because it was familiar to people. It was what people had been brought up with. So it helped people to access church because it had that familiar language that they'd been brought up on. But we're now in a generation where people haven't been brought up in church. And so it's become a barrier. It's made it harder to access church. And so I think we're probably looking at a time when we need to say, actually, we know it's beautiful and we might still love it, but we want to put it aside because it's stopping people from accessing God better. And look, the church that I'm in now, it's a Victorian church coming up for 200 years old, I think. And we're getting to that point where we're trying to decide, is this a burden on us? Because it's got a spire that's falling down. And we're like, well, we could spend a lot of money to fix this spire, but wouldn't that money be better spent elsewhere? Wouldn't it bring more glory to God if we spent it elsewhere in ways that will help people connect to God, or ways that will just help people, full stop?
I think that's refreshing to hear, actually, because I feel like so many times in the church, it's about holding up what you've always known for so many people rather than adapting to the changes that are all around us all the time and bringing in that new generation of people who are going to know and love God.
Yeah.
So it's refreshing to hear that from as someone like you, especially. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people in the Church of England would probably consider me low church. But, you know, I've inherited here a group of people who see themselves as the church, and it's not about the church building. And to be honest, I think if we ended up having to sell off this building and move into a building that's more in the town centre, a place where we can really connect with people better, sure, there'd be some people who'd be really sad about it. But I think, you know, on the whole, people would be like, that's okay, because it's the mission of God that's important. It's not about keeping these traditions alive for no reason. We want it to be something that's meaningful. And I think for me, that's how it relates back to the tabernacle. But I think that as long as the tabernacle's meaningful for God's people, it's a positive thing for them to have. But as soon as it becomes something that's become a meaningless ritual and starts distracting them or making God less accessible to them, then it's, you know, it's not as useful anymore.
Which literally happens within the Bible itself.
Yeah. Like,
there's, you know, there's so many stories in the Bible where there's a tension between religion and God, right?
Yeah.
All the way through.
Yeah. Know, yeah.
Kind of one of the points of Jesus's whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, I think that is probably, I mean, that was awesome. That was very cool.
It's great. And thank you guys for inviting me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for coming.
Cool. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you to Reverend Chris. Hey, the tabernacle's fun. See?
It's good for kids, too.
See? I knew we could do it. So, a big question that I had while reading this is, like, why does God go from being guy who says low church piles of rocks in the middle of nowhere are cool to being guy who says complex ritual is cool? And, you know, we heard a pretty good explanation there that, like, hey, it's all cool. The superstar Jewish scholar Maimonides, medieval guy, argued this was God meeting the Israelites halfway. Physical objects help you worship, you folks who've spent 400 years around Egyptian shrines. Working hard on gold and linen helps you think highly of your worship space. Great, we'll try it your way. God only cares about this stuff so much. It's for us.
I feel like it's like a starting point, because when you have all of these formal things and then you branch off to these low church things, you at least know where it came from or why you do it a certain way, so that you have a little bit more understanding of it all together.
Yeah, it's about making the story stick.
Right.
And taking the story with you wherever you are.
And by having all of these specific things, you'll keep some of that, even if you don't remember all of it. You'll keep some of that and remember that, and that gets carried on. So without those formalities, a lot of things would be very different, probably.
Yeah. The behind-the-story stuff about the design of the tabernacle, scholars have written about how the tabernacle's design, if you picture it, because lots of people have recreated it, and not just in Minecraft, it looks like a mishmash of local influences, like Pharaoh Ramesses' actual war tent. It looks very Egyptian. So God is using things the Israelites know to build himself an earthly abode, which is what the word for tabernacle means. In the storyline, God is saying, if this will help us get along the way I want to get along, fine. And outside the storyline, the very Egyptian design for the tabernacle is another sign, perhaps, Moses is bringing a single God version of Egypt's religion or a Midianite religion to the Canaanite pantheon, merging, creating our idea of God. Also, the tabernacle story is very likely written well after the time of Moses. And at some point, somebody had to provide an origin story for Solomon's temple. How did this religion go from little rock shrines in the middle of nowhere to Solomon's temple? The tabernacle myth is the bridge. God told them to make a structure like this, and at first, it was mobile. Now it's not. They walked the tabernacle into Canaan and built a temple around it. Did that really, really happen? I don't know. I wasn't there. But how else do you write a story that connects a temple built in maybe the 900s to a religion allegedly handed down hundreds of miles away, hundreds of years earlier? Our good friend Richard Freeman, he wrote Leviticus, Chronicles, Lamentations, Psalms, Kings, the Talmud, and the historian Josephus all offer evidence that the tabernacle was understood to be inside Solomon's temple the entire time. Thinking of this as a retroactive myth also helped explain why God's telling them to build something in the middle of nowhere that would be extremely hard to build in the middle of nowhere.
Where did all the materials come from? They had an abundance.
The trees, you could probably find. It would take a long time, depending on exactly where you are. But a lot of the other stuff, like, they need expensive purple Phoenician dyes. And these days, you could go to, I don't know, Hobby Lobby or Michael's or whatever.
Maybe Walmart, even.
But they would have had to rely on, let's say, purple Phoenician dyes, which Phoenicia's pretty far away. They're probably not just wandering around the middle of Sinai.
I mean, they very well could have. I mean, I know that when they left Egypt, they still had a lot of these riches. So some of the things could have come from that.
Yeah, maybe there's a wandering merchant who just isn't mentioned. But they would have needed to just acquire a lot of random stuff in order to be prepared to make this thing. There's an expensive clear olive oil that would have been rare in Egypt, let alone Sinai. You can find a few translations that say God wanted them to use dolphin skins for part of the tabernacle.
So sad.
It's not a majority translation, but either way, there is no verse that says, "And along with manna, the Lord provided Phoenicians olive oil and dolphins so they could follow the blueprints." The tabernacles were playing, speaking of Minecraft, creative mode, not survival mode. They're creating a picture of what a space that worships this god would look like, whether they were definitely able to do it out there or not. They're explaining the thing that preceded the big building in Jerusalem, giving their whole physical presence an awesome origin story. Also, in addition to the tabernacle's Egyptian influences, Frank Moore Cross argues all of this has a pretty clear ancient Canaanite influences. Canaan's all-father god El, who was part of the pantheon that contributed to the idea of Yahweh, also lived in a tent. So, it's possible we're just still adapting all the super old stuff. Obviously, this is a huge moment in the Jewish religion. Regardless of where and when and what exactly happened, to this day, many newly constructed synagogues still reflect the tabernacle schematics. The tabernacle is a machine. Machines are made of parts, powered by fuel, designed to accomplish a task. God laid out the parts, explained the fuel, and explained the task. If you follow these steps, I will give you a fire show that'll prove I'm with you. Would God still be with them even if they didn't do that stuff? Well, probably, based on Genesis, and definitely based on the fact no one has sacrificed according to the Torah in almost 2,000 years, and yet God is with us anyway. God told Cain hundreds of years earlier in the story that being a good person rather than sacrifice is the main thing. Leviticus has all sorts of provisions that allow poor people to sacrifice very little, which shows it's less about what you sacrifice, more about the fact you're choosing to commune with God. We mentioned Hosea, Jesus. The Bible has both endless rules about how to do church and reminders that church is just church.
Something for everyone in that way.
Finally, they get to work actually setting up the tabernacle. Yeah, all that was just them, like, gathering supplies. The first people to line up appear to be the women, and then the men join beside them, if you read a verse a certain way, which I choose to do. The construction takes several chapters, and the boring repetition of God's blueprint has a story purpose. They are listening meticulously. No golden calf repeat yet. Exodus 39:32, the work of the tabernacle is completed, and the Israelites did as God told Moses. God saw that it's good. It is finished, for now God now has a throne, the Shekinah. Did you ever hear this word?
I think only from you.
Okay. It's an ancient rabbinical word for the settled presence of God, God in a physical place. I grew up evangelicals treating this as a very, like, impressive, learned word. Like, look at this word I know. I'm not sure how aware they are that the Shekinah has feminine connotations, especially in the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah goes all in on God, transcending and including genders. And the Shekinah, the part of God that is most connected to us on earth, is, you could describe it as, like, the most feminine part of God. Speaking of, God is described many times later in the Bible, like a mother, a womb, a mother bird. There are references in the Bible to the goddess, I've seen the name pronounced many ways, Asherah, who was a female counterpart to some of the ancient Canaanite and Sumerian gods who contributed to the Bible's idea of God. Somewhere deep within the idea of what became God, there was a goddess. It's also noteworthy that the Israelite women were helping at least as much as the men in setting up the tabernacle, that the women were in charge of the fabrics, that Moses' sister Miriam just earned the prophet title a few chapters ago. And there's what Carol Myers describes as some verses here and elsewhere that describe women as having some sort of tabernacle maintenance role. Exodus was edited by dudes and mostly interpreted by dudes and is mostly about a dude and his idea of a dude god, but Exodus starts with a rebellious mother and sister and arguably ends with the divine feminine residing in a tent built as much by women as by men. So what is the point of mentioning lady stuff here? Because God, being kinda a lady, and the church being made and maintained in part by ladies, shows this story is saying, if we let it, that church is for everybody, regardless of how long and oily the beards are on the guys who wrote the story. So I also want to try and do this. The pronoun he is the familiar pronoun for God. It's the one used in the Bible. I want to try and get away from it and go with they for God. Probably won't always happen, especially for quoting, but I think it makes so much more sense. Oh, but that's not very monotheist. Well, go cry about it, okay? neither am I, okay?
Yes, I'd say you are.
God is too big to be contained by monotheism. Take that, all right?
Bigger than that.
God is here at the tent of meeting because she likes Moses, the human who bickers with her like a spouse about their children. Jack Miles, my favorite sentence of his, the volcano has come to live in the tent because the tent was built by the volcano's friend. Exodus ends still at Mount Sinai, 40 chapters revolving around fire and smoke and a mountain. Egyptian boy Moses found an ancient god here, blurting from a tiny fire. God liberated the Israelites with blood and fire and smoke. The Israelites found God at this mountain, leveled up into a massive smoking fire. God gave the Israelites rules at Sinai, all revolving around how to create empowering smoke. Now God's people are leaving the mountain, following God's pillar of smoke, and the plan is this: replenish the fire every day and the smoke will lead you home. That's it. That's Exodus. They said it couldn't be.
We did it. 400 years later, we did it.
So Exodus, if we were to give it a star rating, do you, as someone who hasn't actually read the whole thing, what would you go with?
4.5 stars.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You're that confident in the tabernacle stuff?
Well, it's not going to like take away from the other stuff that's in there.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
It's difficult. If it was just the first half, I would probably go 5, but it really gets dragged down.
There's just so much. The majority of the Bible stories that you hear as a kid come from Genesis and Exodus. Mm-hmm. So aside from anything that happens with Jesus, this is what we know.
It's a large, large portion of it. I'm going to go with 4 stars. There's so much to love, but so much to breeze through. And it Genesis is awesome. Next up, the Levites give us a big rule book on how to live as God's people in God's land. Leviticus.
Dun, dun, dun.
Appropriate. That stuff I just said about church being for everybody. Leviticus says otherwise. Don't. That doesn't. Spoiler alert. I mean, it can try to. It can try to all at once. But we can say otherwise. Leviticus is the most feared, most difficult, least enjoyed, most confusing, most barbaric, most outdated book in the whole Bible, and I love almost all of it one way or the other. We're going to de-weaponize what we can, contextualize what we can, and find way more peace, joy, compassion, mercy, and flagrant progressive social justice, yeah, in Leviticus than I ever would have expected.
Can't wait.
It's not all like that, but I think there's a lot of stuff that some of our angriest pastors would be pretty surprised to realize is in Leviticus. And that's it. We will see you next time on the Vacation Bible School Podcast.